also that the males, as opposed to the females, took a lot longer to mature. And by taking a lot longer to mature, they presumed that they were like the gorillas. And so just seeing in this fact that they take longer, but what they notice is that the males within Paranthropus robustus keep growing after their wisdom teeth come in. And, you know, like if you look at the human population, by the time the wisdom teeth come in, we basically stop growing. That's true of both males and females. But in the case of Paranthropus robustus, the males keep growing after the wisdom teeth come in. And so they immediately jump to the conclusion that our ancient, quote, ancestors are just like the gorillas. And with the gorillas, you notice that some of the males get to be three times the size of the females. And so in terms of sexual dimorphism, they're kind of at the extreme. And the females stop growing when their wisdom teeth come in, but the male gorillas keep on growing. And what these authors are trying to claim on the BBC, by the way, the peer-reviewed article just came out this week. It's in the latest Science. And one reason why I'm going through this discovery is it's interesting how different the public announcements are from what is actually published in the peer-reviewed literature. The peer-reviewed literature does document that indeed there is sexual dimorphism for this hominid species. But if you actually look in the paper, there is no quantitative information. Indeed, they have 35 skulls for these creatures, but most of the skulls are partial skulls. And so all they're able to do in the paper is to show qualitatively, not quantitatively, that the males continue maturing after their wisdom teeth come in. I kept going through the paper to find out, well, how much did they mature? How much bigger did they get? That's not in there. All they could do is rank the different specimens and say if the females rank lower than the males, but they couldn't tell you by how much, and that the older males ranked as having continued to grow more than the young adult males. So it's strictly qualitative. There's nothing quantitative in here, and yet we see the BBC and the big newspapers, the Times in London, the Telegraph, all claiming that this means that the hominids were like the gorillas, and therefore were like the gorillas, because likewise with the human species, men are bigger than the women, and men take a little longer to mature than the women, and therefore this tells us that this is a social structure that evolved from the hominids all the way up into human beings. And what I found most alarming from a Christian perspective, they claim that this really indicates that we are genetically engineered to have many wives, and for the men to compete with one another so that they can have these harems. So it's a justification of the harem style of social structure. And naturally, this is offensive to a Christian worldview perspective. But when you actually get into the research paper, what the research paper points out very interestingly is that, yes, we can see extreme dimorphism for the gorillas, and there's apparent dimorphism for this particular species of hominid, but they also point out that for the Australopithecines, they can't document any sexual dimorphism, and if anything, the females might be a little bit bigger than the males. But they said the data is not substantial enough that we can tell that the females were a little bit bigger than the males. They could be, but not necessarily. And so they wind up concluding in the paper that what we see in the hominids, the different species of hominids, is different social structures. And, you know, why would you have different social structures if indeed these species are related through some natural evolutionary process? So rather than the paper supporting a naturalistic evolutionary paradigm for the hominids and for human beings, it actually gives you the opposite. It documents that there's differences, at least between the Australopithecines and this Paranthropus robustus. They must have different social structures because the sizes are different. But in terms of what they're really trying to talk about in BBC is that, you know, because men have bigger bodies and because they, quote, compete with females so they can have these harems. And what they actually imply is, well, of course, men don't do that today. What they do instead is that they have multiple wives in a serial fashion. They'll marry one, have her for a few years, divorce her, marry another one, divorce her, marry another one, that kind of thing. That's how we practice this genetically original thing that we inherited from the hominid species. That's the claim. But when you really look into it, what is the difference in terms of maturation for human males and human females? Well, it's about a year. And a year isn't much in terms of taking 20 years to mature. It really doesn't make that much difference. And our size difference isn't nothing like the gorillas. Moreover, there may be a different reason why we are bigger as men compared to females than just sexual competition. Given that you have these family structures, someone has to go out and build the houses and, you know, take care of the farms and get the game in terms of getting civilization off the ground. And therefore, it makes sense just from the perspective of trying to raise a successful family that you'd have the male a little bit bigger than the female, and have the male with a different muscular structure. It's necessary that the females be able to protect the children that are growing within them. Men don't need that, and therefore they can have a higher proportion of a muscle to body mass ratio than what you see with the women. But I'd also argue that it's disputable that human males die off faster than females. Indeed, that's what the statistics show, at least for the 19th and the 20th century. But one study I'm aware of makes a point that if you discount the fact that men tend to smoke more than women and men tend to drink more alcohol than women, that you really see no difference in the age span. That if you take out the alcohol factor and the smoking factor, you have men and women living about the same number of years. There really isn't a distinguishable difference. And therefore, it's really hard to justify this case that men are dying off faster because of sexual competition, or dying off faster for other reasons that not sexual competition. And therefore, there's no basis for concluding on this study of Paranthropus robustus that indeed we were not structured to have families in the Christian tradition, but rather to have these harems with all kinds of children and a bunch of males running around that don't have families at all. That's not supported, in my opinion, by the study. But I think the reason why I brought it to your attention, it really is interesting how different the peer-reviewed article was from the stuff that was sent out all over the web, and primarily through the agency of the BBC and the big British newspapers. And they were picked up by a number of American newspapers as well. And the problem with this, just to, you know, kind of inform you on this, is that the public announcements that get out over the web and on TV and radio, they typically come out 2 to 3, sometimes 4 weeks earlier than the peer-reviewed article comes out. And if that's what everybody hears, and the peer-reviewed article comes out, does it make the BBC or the London Times? No, it doesn't really make the pages. They say we've already reported on that. So in that sense, we have to be careful about that kind of distortion. Anything I want to talk about before we jump into Psalm 65 and finish that off is just to make an announcement. The Reasons to Believe is now doing podcasts. We call them Science News Flashes. And they're on iTunes. So you can go to iTunes and listen to our podcast. And unlike other groups that do these kinds of podcasts, we don't charge. They're free. So if you've got an iTunes account, and you can register for iTunes without paying any money, you can download our podcast. The one we did Friday afternoon is a study that actually tied into something we talked about last week. And, you know, Psalm 65 was addressing how God builds the mountains and the continents for the benefit of human beings and all life. Well, there's a new paper that came out in the latest edition of Nature that actually complements what we discussed last week in terms of these discoveries that talk about plate tectonics and how Earth is really unique in its capacity to have long-lasting and stable plate tectonics. This paper in Nature talks about how Plate tectonics combined with a superabundance of early life on planet Earth prevented our planet from experiencing a runaway climate problem, a runaway climate catastrophe. Now, the runaway climate catastrophes, and what the paper actually implies, is that unless you've got a planet like Earth with aggressive, long-lasting, stable plate tectonics, and also aggressive, long-lasting superabundance of life on the planet, then the planet will suffer a runaway climate catastrophe. Now, the runaway climate catastrophe is what would happen to planet Earth, for example, if you were to have a little bit of global warming, where the temperature goes up by a degree on the average day. And then what that will do is it will cause more water to be evaporated, and that's going to result in more effective greenhouse shield on the Earth. And with a more effective greenhouse, that's going to cause more heat to be trapped, and the greater heat that is trapped is going to cause more carbon dioxide and water to be pumped into the atmosphere, and so you get what's called a runaway evaporation of the planet's water. And when that happens, all life dies on the planet, and you'll have a sterile planet. That's what's called a runaway vaporization of the water. And you know, how much of a disturbance do you need to get that? Well, if you were to have the luminosity of the sun impinging on the planet change by 0.4%, that would be enough. You'll make it greater by 0.4%. That's enough to set off a runaway vaporization of the water. Now, the same thing happens if you're to have the solar luminosity dim by 0.4%. And, of course, there's two ways to do that. Again, if the sun actually getting dimmer, or you can have the greenhouse effect becoming less effective. Well, how this would work is if you got the planet experiencing a tiny instability so that it gets a little bit cooler, what happens? Well, more snow will fall from the sky, and more of that snow will remain as ice. And the problem with ice and snow is it reflects light more efficiently than dirt does. And because it reflects light more efficiently than dirt does, that means more sunlight gets reflected to outer space, which means the planet gets a little bit cooler. And when it gets a little bit cooler, that means more snow and ice will form, which makes it even cooler, and more snow and ice forms, and you get the Earth turning into a giant snowball. And then the planet becomes permanently sterile. And again, a 0.4% change in temperature, making it too cold or too warm, is enough to make that happen. Well, what these researchers point out is it's impossible for a planet to avoid a 0.4% change over billions of years. If for no other reason, for example, our sun has gotten 15% brighter over the last 3 billion years. And during its first billion and a half years, it got 15% dimmer. It starts off getting dimmer because it loses mass. And when it stops losing mass, then it begins to get brighter as a result of hydrogen being converted into helium in the nuclear furnace of the sun. Helium causes that core of the sun to become denser, which makes the furnace burn brighter and brighter. So that means 10 million years from now, the sun is going to be significantly more luminous than it is today. And a 0.4% change is enough to disturb the balance. Or, for example, if you get a star going by close to the solar system, which has happened several times in the history of our solar system, that could gravitationally disturb the orbit of the planet and put it outside that 0.4% zone. Or you could have some kind of climatic instability where the gas greenhouse effect gets changed by 0.4%. That's enough to get you a runaway problem. Well, the heart of this research paper is pointing out why this didn't happen on planet Earth. And it goes back to the last big instability. There was an enormous instability that took place just before the Cameron explosion. But one of the contributions of this paper is it comes up with a firmer date for when the last snowball event took place. And this is an event where over 80% of the planet became frozen. And but it stopped. I mean, it should have gone all the way to 100% and stayed at 100%. And it didn't happen. And the date, by the way, is 550 million years ago. Now, the Cambrian explosion was 543 million years ago. So just 7 million years before the Cambrian explosion, we have this snowball event. And, you know, it takes a few million years for the snowball event to subside. And when it does, we have this immediate infusion of, you know, dozens of phyla of life that show up for the first time, the Cambrian explosion. That kind of raises an interesting point. Why do we have such an immediate timing of the Cambrian explosion right after the last snowball event? Well, back to the snowball event. What the paper points out is that, yes, as the planet gets cooler, more snow and ice forms, which causes it to get cooler yet, but as it gets cooler and cooler, more and more oxygen from the atmosphere gets put into the seawater. And so as the planet's getting colder, more oxygen gets pulled out of the atmosphere and put into the seawater, and that oxygen will filter down to the bottom of the ocean, some of it anyway, and when it hits the bottom of the ocean, that oxygen will react with dead organic material and make carbonates. It reacts with the dead organic material and the carbonates that are there, and what that does is it releases carbon dioxide. And the carbon dioxide bubbles up to the surface, goes into the atmosphere, and so what's happening is the planet's getting colder and colder, oxygen is being pulled out of the atmosphere, and carbon dioxide is being pumped into the atmosphere as that oxygen filters down to the bottom, reacts with the organic material there, and causes carbon dioxide to be released. But what they point out here is that that carbon dioxide eventually will build up to a point where it reverses the snowball. So unlike other planets, which would have had a runaway freeze take place where it would be permanent, on planet Earth that didn't happen because of the huge abundance of dead organic material in the bottom of the ocean. That provided a resource whereby significant enough amounts of carbon dioxide could be pumped back into the atmosphere that eventually you get enough carbon dioxide in the atmosphere that it causes the temperature to go up because more heat from the sun gets trapped, and it stops the snowball from growing, which explains why it only hit 80% of the planet. And then once you get enough carbon dioxide there, it begins to recede and go back. As I mentioned last week, that combines with the effect of volcanoes. Volcanoes also return carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, but not enough. It takes a combination of these two effects to build the carbon dioxide up enough where you can reverse the snowball effect. So unless you've got a huge abundance of life on the planet and a huge accumulation of dead organic material on the bottom of the ocean floor, you're not going to have a mechanism that's going to stabilize a planet and prevent a runaway freeze-up or a runaway evaporation of the water. Yes. Well, it's been 550 million years since we've had the last snowball event. And there are many scientists who think that the probability of getting another... And by the way, the authors of this paper say we should change the term in the scientific literature from snowball event to slushball event. And the rationale there is that the snow and ice never reaches a point where things get so cold that it can't be reversed. You know, slush is something that you can possibly melt. And your question again, I forgot. Where are we in the cycle? There's some who believe that the cycle is over. That between 4 billion years ago and 550 million years ago, the planet experienced between 3 and 5 snowball events. But that we probably will not get another snowball event. And the reason why is that for the last 3 billion years, the sun is beginning hotter and hotter. And that will continue to take place. So the sun's luminosity is going to continue to rise. And some models indicate that the sun is now so bright that the possibility of getting another snowball event just isn't there. What we have to work so hot that you'll get a sterilization event with all the water being evaporated. But that the idea that we can get another slush fall event or a snowball event probably isn't there, because now the sun is just too bright to make that happen. Well, these snowball events are separated by about a half billion years each, anywhere from half a billion to a billion years each. So you've got a long slush fall cycle, whereas the ice age cycle is on the order of 100,000 years. Every 100,000 years you get an ice age. Every 750 million years you get a snowball ice age. And if you look at the ice ages over the history of the planet, you notice there's a lot of variation on the extent of the ice age. Some of them are small ice ages where they only get down to the Canadian border. The last ice age, for example, penetrated considerably south of the Canadian border. And so that all the northern states were also covered with ice. In fact, there was ice halfway down into California. Yosemite Valley was filled with ice during the last ice age. And so the last ice age was particularly severe. And it's rare to get ice ages that go anywhere south of San Francisco. But about every 750 million years, you'll get an ice age. You'll go all the way down to Guatemala. So, yes. Well, I believe so, and I believe that the hint for that is included in Job 38 and 39. That we're going to study a little bit about it this morning in our text. And, you know, the bottom line is this, is that the biblical injunction on how to manage the planet for the benefit of all life and keep the planet stable so that it provides plenty of food for all life is to focus on the water cycle. In other words, I think in terms of global warming, we're making a mistake on focusing on the temperature. We should be focusing on the water. So, for example, one of the ways that we could significantly reverse the effects of global warming would be to reverse the spread of the Sahara Desert. If we can make the Sahara Desert as tiny as it was before human beings showed up on the scene, that would do a lot to pull carbon dioxide and water out of the atmosphere, and therefore reduce the greenhouse effect. Now, the desert got bigger because of human abuse. Nature had nothing to do with it. And we're to blame for the Sahara Desert being as huge as it is. I think the Sahara Desert right now is about the size of Canada. So it's really big, whereas, you know, as recently as the days of the Romans, it was a relatively small desert. Empire era, the Sahara Desert region was the breadbasket for the Roman Empire. That's where they got all their grain from. And they actually had a fair number of forest products coming out of what is now the Sahara Desert. And so if we were to reverse that, and how do you reverse it? Well, you do the opposite of what we did to make it. We could reverse that Sahara Desert, have trees covering much more of Africa, a lot more plant cover, and that will pull a lot more carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere. Although long term, our big worry is what's going to happen when we run out of fossil fuels. Because actually what we're doing as a population, we're delaying the onset of the next ice age by burning fossil fuels. But we're burning those fossil fuels at a faster rate than is necessary to stave off the next ice age. We'd be much wiser to burn those fossil fuels at a much slower rate and therefore extend the time that we could have before we're going to inevitably run into an ice age. And just to put things in context, human activity has already delayed the onset of the next ice age by 5,000 years. Burning fossil fuels will delay it at the rate we're burning those fossil fuels by only 400 more years. When those 400 years are up, then we're going to face a very sharp drop into a colder climate condition. If we burn those fossil fuels at a slower rate, we could put it off another 4,000 years. Right. Global warming is inevitable. Right. However, if you wait for the sun to bring about inevitable global warming, we're now talking 10 million years instead of 400 years. You know, it makes a big difference. But, you know, bottom line is we are doomed on this planet. In fact, a number of astronomers have been making the point that it's not too soon for us to look for another planet because, you know, this planet isn't going to sustain us that much longer. But here we can bring a biblical perspective to bear. Well, you know, God never intended for us to live for all of eternity on planet Earth. The sun's going to burn out, and within 10 million years it's going to be too bright to sustain human activity. Cockroaches will make it another 10 million years. But in 30 million years, everything dies. The planet will be sterile in 30 million years, even if we do everything we can to make our planet as viable as possible. Yes. Right. Well, if that were to happen, yeah, if that were to happen, we wouldn't have to worry about global warming, that's for sure. With 65 million... Oh, it did. Yeah, when that happened, things got very cold. But there again, there was resources on the planet to prevent it from becoming a permanent situation. And so, the bottom line of this paper in Nature is, we have long-term stable life on this planet because we also, in addition to having a powerful abundance of dead organic material. No matter whatever epoch you look at on planet Earth, there's always a... And that gives us a safety valve to prevent these kinds of disasters from becoming permanent. So, yes. Well, yeah, if we're talking human life, there's a lot of things that could be. If a supernova explodes relatively close to our solar system, then all human beings will die. If a gamma ray burst goes off anywhere within the local group or anywhere within the Virgo cluster, that would wipe out all human life on one half of the planet. That's the nice thing about a gamma ray burst. It only lasts about 15 seconds. And so it will blast one hemisphere and leave the other hemisphere alone. So only half the human species gets wiped out. But an asteroid colliding with the Earth or a comet colliding with the Earth, that's a mile in diameter, that too will wipe out all human beings. But bacteria would survive, cockroaches would survive, just human beings wouldn't survive. So because we are so large in our body size and so advanced in terms of our protein structures, we are the species that's most subject to being exterminated by these kinds of events. So in that sense, it's good that the Bible tells us that God has us on this planet for a short period of time. He has us here to bring about the conquest of evil, and when evil is conquered and removed, then the universe, from God's perspective, will have fulfilled its purpose, and this is when he moves us from one universe to a new universe, which is why I say the multiverse, at least in one context, is a Christian doctrine. Yes. Well, what will happen to Pasadena? It's before or after the Rose Bowl. Well, plate tectonics is a wonderful alleviating factor in that it buries a lot of that organic material. And when it's buried, it's cut off from the atmosphere. And so that prevents the carbon dioxide from being released to the atmosphere and running into one of these situations where you wind up having all the water evaporated away. But also when that organic material gets buried, it is sequestered, which means you have an opportunity for that carbon dioxide to be released later. And so you have a snowball event or a big ice age. You can alleviate that through volcanic activity, for example, which can take that carbon dioxide or carbonates that have been put into the crust of the Earth and put it back into the atmosphere. So one of the things this paper points out in Nature is that planet Earth has these unique positive feedback cycles. So if things get too warm, it's going to stimulate more plant growth. That plant growth is going to pull more greenhouse gases to the atmosphere and cool things down. So that's a positive feedback mechanism to prevent the planet from getting too warm. We also have a positive feedback mechanisms in place that prevent the planet from getting too cold. But these positive feedback mechanisms won't work unless you have lots of life on the planet, both living material and dead material, and then powerful, stable plate tectonics. You need all that to work for these positive feedback mechanisms to operate. But these positive feedback mechanisms have limits. Those positive feedback mechanisms have been effective in keeping the planet filled with life for the past 3.8 billion years, but at most we can put that off for another 20 million years. After that, the feedback mechanisms will be overcome by the rising luminosity of the sun. No feedback mechanism can handle that. And that's because in order to pull enough carbon dioxide and water to the atmosphere to compensate for the increased luminosity of the sun, you've now got so little carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, you can't sustain photosynthetic plant activity. Well, one thing this paper points out interestingly is that global warming by human activity is not going to be bring about the extinction of all life on the planet, just human extinction. I mean, the rest of life will do fine. Because human activity is going to disturb things for a short period of time. The thing about these positive feedback mechanisms, they're relatively slow. So if you put a huge pulse into the environment where the temperature goes up very rapidly over the course of 100 years, these positive feedback mechanisms will be overcome. They won't be able to handle it. It's too fast of a change. But give it a million years, it'll be able to correct the problem that we human beings caused. And so what they point out in the paper is, yes, these feedback mechanisms will take care of human abuse, but only on a long-term basis, not on a short-term basis. Right, Tom English. Yeah. Well, no, there's definitely the risk of doing a bad pulse, because you know, human technology and human population is such today that we have the power that we lacked 100 years ago from a, you know, bringing about that kind of a pulse. But you know what this paper is pointing out is that, yeah, we humans can do these things and really mess things up for ourselves, but there are self-correcting positive feedback mechanisms that will take care of it eventually. It's just that we might not be around to enjoy the benefits of that correction. And therefore, it's incumbent upon us human beings to pay attention to these decade-type pulses that we can induce. But, you know, if I could speak for Mike Phillips, who isn't here today, he would argue that there's actually a positive feedback that works to control the human population. And it's just now starting to kick in. And once you get the population up into the billions like it is now, you're basically forcing people off the farm and into the cities. And when you do that, you now provide a powerful motivation for people to have less children. Because if you live in a city, having lots of children becomes a serious economic drain as opposed to living on a farm. And so this explains why once countries become so overpopulated that their population is forced to live in big cities, you see the birth rate begin to drop. And that dropping birth rate will eventually cause the human population to shrink. Although people estimate that probably won't happen until the year 2050. 2050 is a projected year when you're actually going to see the world population beginning to decline rather than continuing to increase. And so we may reach, you know, a plateau of 8 billion people. That could happen. That could be a maximum. But that's part of our study today in Psalm 65. Has God anticipated this in advance? And I think he has. But questions? Well, sure, it could be serious social disturbances. I mean, I think the biggest social disturbance we're looking for in the future is what's going to happen in China. And to a lesser degree in India. You know, in Chinese, what you're seeing is people saying, well, we've got to do something about the population. They passed the law, one child per couple. Well, you know, in China, if you have a choice between a son or a daughter, you're going to go with the son because, you know, that's kind of their social security system. The son will take care of him. The daughter, no guarantee. And so what's happening, and it's very obvious in China today, is you've got a huge surplus of men. And when you've got a huge surplus of men, that's a ticket for social disturbance. Those guys are going to want to find wives when they grow up. So what's going to happen when they can't find the wives? It's happening in India as well, even though they don't have a law. Well, I mean, this is serious. I mean, the two largest populations in the world, I mean, India's got 1 billion people now. China's got nearly 1.5 billion. And these are two nations that are seriously short of females. And being such a huge population, it'd be easy for them to think of, well, if we declare war on nations that have lots of females, this is going to help us. And by the way, that's taken place throughout human history. Whenever a nation has had a huge surplus of males compared to women, they've gone to war. So, I mean, the idea that India and China could actually become aggressive in their policy. And, you know, what I find interesting is that where are all the Chinese women? They've basically been exported to the U.S. Because that's what's happening now. If people have a female and they don't want the female in China, they'll work with an American adoption agency for the women to be exported. We have an employee at our office who has 3 Chinese girls. He says the Chinese don't want their girls. We do. We take them. Well, I can easily imagine a scenario where the Chinese figure, gee, all of our women, or a lot of our women, are in America. Let's see if we can claim them back. And it would be difficult for these American parents to give back their Chinese daughters. So, again, a prescription for social instability. Yeah. Well, we studied all that about 25 years ago in this class, and we had a 7-year Sunday school program and going through the Book of Revelation, where we looked at those kinds of issues. I think the tapes are still available. Although I want to remind you that the people in the class did refer to that 7-year Sunday school program as the tribulation period. So, well, 7.5. All right. So, wasn't quite the same as yes. Well, not only have you ever heard Mike Phillips here in the class. He's a statistician over at Cal State Northridge speak, but he's involved with a group of sociologists and statisticians where they think the human population without war and without famine could be 1 billion by the year 2100. And, you know, there's two factors. I already mentioned one. Urbanization motivates people to have fewer children. The other thing that motivates people to have fewer children is affluence. One study that Mike Phillips has been involved in is that when the per capita income exceeds $3,500 per year, people will begin to have children at a lower rate than the replacement rate. And you know, you've seen that. Once a nation reaches a certain level of wealth, they stop having children. One of the things he was pointing out is that once a civilization reaches a point where electric lights become common, they stop having more children than the replacement factor. So, you can read into that whatever you want. but the other factor is technology. That technology is a serious dent on reproduction in the sense that what technology does is it forces both the men and the women to put off getting married. Because you need to have the education to be able to survive in a high-tech society. I mean, in my case, I didn't get out of my educational experience until I was 27. And there was just no way I could even think about marriage until I hit, you know, past the age of 27. What's happening to the world population at large? And so that also causes people to have fewer children. And the combination of all those effects is a serious drop in the birth rate. And, for example, even in Catholic Italy, where, you know, they have strong social pressure against birth control and abortion, they now have 0.7 children per adult. And so the population of Italy is in serious decline. And just to give you an idea, Russia is losing a million people a year. Their population drops by 1 million every year. And so they'll have fewer than 100 million people by the end of the century. There was a question here first. Well, keep in mind that when our nation went to war against Britain back in the 18th century, the average number of children per American couple was 10. And that was because having lots of children meant that you could take care of a bigger farm. And farmland was abundant. The only thing stopping you from becoming a wealthy man was you didn't have enough children to be able to take care of all the farming. And so people were highly motivated to have children because it made them wealthier. Well, you know, someone living in downtown Los Angeles, 10 children, that's 10 college educations you got to. Look at Kenya. Kenya used to have a... In fact, last time I was in Kenya, it was 8 children per woman. It's way less than that. It's now dropped to 4. The average Kenyan woman has 4 children rather than 8. That's all taken place just in the last, 15 years. So that's, again, responsible for the fact that Kenya is a nation where they're now having factories of people living in cities, where in the old days it was all on the farm. Yeah. Reminds me of what my son said to me. They said, you know, Dad, you better start saving money because you can't count on us. So, oh, okay. Well, I think all of us want the end times to come because that means we don't have to put up with all this evil anymore. But what does this book say? Occupy till I come. It also says that we're to take care of the planet in an optimal fashion, not just for our benefit, but the benefit of all life until I come. So that's why we at Reasons to Believe do support this green initiative within the Christian community, that we need to do what we can to make this planet as pleasant a planet for all life concerned. And nevertheless, we are concerned that the secular green movement is actually going to make things worse with their objectives. You know, one of the objectives they have is we need to put in place policies that will guarantee that we won't have any extinction events. Well, that's a great way to make sure you've got more extinction events, because there is a residual extinction event you're going to get just by natural process. But a worthy goal, in my opinion, would be to reduce the extinction rate to the natural level. The extinction rate is way beyond the natural level because of human abuse. Let's bring it down to the natural level. If you try to bring it down to zero, that's a prescription for making things worse. Yes. Well, let me just speak from the perspective of the Bible, because this is one thing that those three faiths all have in common. I mean, the difference between Judaism, Christianity, and Islam is the length of their holy books. The holy book of the Jews is the Old Testament. The holy book of the Christians is the Old Testament and the New Testament. And for Mormonism and Islam, they have these additional holy books that go beyond. Now, the one big difference, however, is that unlike Muslims and Mormons, Christians do not deny any of the content of the Old Testament. You don't see Christians coming along and saying the New Testament supersedes the Old Testament. Christians say the Old Testament is entirely true. It's a revelation from God. It's entirely inspired. It's just as inerrant as the New Testament is. Whereas what you have in Islam is this teaching that the Jews and the Christians have corrupted their holy book, and that we have a book that is superior to the Old and New Testament and corrects all the mistakes and errors in it. So that immediately makes for a fairly significant division. But what you do see both in Judaism and in Christianity is this doctrine that this universe will come to an end and will be replaced by a new one, and that the eternal home of humanity is not this universe, but the new creation that will come, and that this new creation will be made available once the fullness of the number of those that will be saved has been reached, to quote Romans chapter 8. But Jews believe that too. They have a different idea of what that means, but they also believe that we're not looking at a nuclear war or some kind of catastrophe. What's going to bring about the end of times is the human species finishing the mission that God has given us. So when people ask me, when will the end come? When we human beings have done what God has told us to do. He's given us specific instructions. You know, we're to manage the planet for the benefit of all life, and while we're doing that, we're to use the resources of the planet to take the message of salvation to all the people groups. This is what we have here in Psalm 65 in our text, of which we only got a few minutes to go on it. But getting into Psalm 65, it makes the point that God has provided us with a tremendous abundance of resources. There's a reason why He's given us a tremendous abundance, so that we can go out into the whole world and take the good news of salvation through Jesus Christ to all the population groups. That can't be done without technology. It can't be done without a large human population. So what God told Adam and Eve is that they were to multiply and fill the earth. And so the idea that God only intended us to have a few million individuals, that's not a biblical doctrine. He wanted us to get up into the billions. It takes that to occupy the whole planet. But now that you occupy the whole planet, you now have the resources to manage, you know, take inventory and manage the resources of the whole planet for the benefit of all life. But you also have the means to be able to take the message of salvation to all the people groups. And I love what Ralph Winter has said over at the U.S. Center for World Mission. He sometimes comes to this class. He says, evangelical Christians today already have sufficient funds, sufficient technology, and sufficient numbers of people to complete the Great Commission that God gave us at the end of the book of Matthew, to take the good news of salvation to all the people groups of the world. We can do it in 5 years. What we lack is the motivation. We simply aren't prepared to put the resources in it, even though God has provided these resources. And that's kind of the theme you see in Psalm 65, that God has given us these huge resources. And you know, we just heard mentioned the population of the world at the time of the Romans, when this New Testament was being formed, was only 250 million. And today it's 6.6 billion people. And it's scheduled to go up to a maximum of probably 8 billion people before it begins to decline. Although some say it will hit a peak of 7 billion and decline. But, you know, it's going to get a little bit bigger. And yet we notice that this planet has been designed by our Creator in such a way that it can provide an abundance of food for the human population when it's small, when it's medium, and even when it's very large. I mean, it's amazing to consider that as large as the human population is today, there is still an abundance of food. There's not only an abundance of food, that food is still very enjoyable. I mean, people were predicting that when the population would hit a certain level, we'd all be forced to eat nothing but corn and wheat. That hasn't happened. We're 6.6 billion people, and people all over the world have a very diverse and enjoyable diet. We do have famines, but the famines are there because of human abuse. War and distribution problems are really responsible for why we have people starving. And it's been that way ever since Adam and Eve have been on the planet. Yes, there are famines, but the famines can't be faulted on God. The Creator has provided a tremendous abundance of food, far more than what we need. And it's not just abundance of calories and abundance of nutrients, it's an abundance of form in which we can enjoy. I mean, that's why we have our friends over for dinner, because the food is so pleasant. And we have this great variety, it's colorful, it's beautiful, it's tasteful, and it's a way that we can enjoy life and have fellowship with one another. And it works even when the population is in the billions, it works when it's in the hundreds of millions. And it worked when there's no people on the planet at all. I mean, the amazing thing is that God has designed life in such a way that it can survive just fine without human beings, but it can also tolerate human beings. You consider the design of corn in such a way that it can produce just a few kernels per year, or can produce hundreds of kernels per year. I mean, why would corn do that if it wasn't for human activity? But human beings can come on the scene and make that happen. Or, as I mentioned last week, take away the human beings, how much milk does a cow need to produce to keep its calf going? It only needs to produce a few quarts a day. But God has designed the cow in such a way that it can produce 90 quarts a day. Now, what would happen if you were to release all those cows in the wild that are producing 90 quarts a day? They'd be in big trouble. I mean, my father was a cowboy in a dairy farm just outside of Calgary for a number of years in his youth. And he said, you know, if you were a little bit late, all those cows were screaming at you. You know, milk us, get them, you know, they're in pain. And they want to be milked. And he says, you can't be more than 20 minutes late, otherwise those cows are going to be in serious pain. It's because they've been bred by us human beings that they can produce this huge amount of milk. But we could also tone that down in the human population were to so warrant that we want that toned down. But then you look all across the spectrum of life. All of life has been designed so it's very flexible in what it can produce. It can produce a little, which is just what they need if human beings aren't around, but it can also produce a superabundance if indeed the human need is there. How can you explain that if there is no God? This is what you see in Acts 14:17. Paul is speaking. He's in Derbe and Lystra, and he's speaking to unbelievers, and he says this in verse 17. Yet he has not left himself without testimony, referring to God. God has shown kindness by giving you rain from heaven and crops in their seasons. He provides you with plenty of food and fills your hearts with joy. What Paul is indicating here is that we Christians should be using the superabundance of life on this planet as an evangelistic tool. How can we persuade people there's a God out there that cares for you and loves you? Look at the life on this planet. How can you explain that life being able to provide so flexibly a tremendous abundance? And it's not just a great abundance, but it's an abundance that we can enjoy as human beings. How can you explain that if all you've got working is naturalistic evolution? Naturalistic evolution, survival of the fittest. In that case, you're going to take energy out of the environment and produce what you need. You're not going to produce a surplus. According to naturalistic evolutionary principles, any individual that produces a surplus of product that they can't use for their own need or the needs of their offspring is going to be weeded out. Survival of the fittest. If you overproduce, that means you're not fit. You're going to get weeded out of the population. We see the opposite here with life on planet Earth, that the life has been designed to produce a superabundance. And one say you can say life is generous, or life is altruistic. Life produces far more than what it needs for its own benefit. The planet has been designed with human beings in mind to provide us with the great abundance that we need. And that great abundance is so that we can fulfill the role that God has given us to fulfill. So in that sense, I'm not worried about a nuclear exchange happening anytime in the near future. According to this book, that's not part of God's plan. Although there is a reference in Ezekiel 39 that you might want to look at, when it does talk about the very time of the end, that last moment of the evangelistic message going out, where it says at that time, fire will rain down on those that dwell in safety in the distant coastlands. And it's referring to the people of Tarshish dwelling safely in the distant coastlands. Who are the people of Tarshish? They're the great European migrators. Well, who lives here in America? The descendants of the great European migrators. And we are indeed living in the distant coastlands, dwelling in safety without fear. And it says rain, fire will rain down upon us. In the very end of the last days, it will also rain down upon the land of Magog. And a lot of people feel the land of Magog is the former Soviet Empire. So that would indicate that there could possibly be room for nuclear exchange. There's also a hint of nuclear activity you'll find in Ezekiel 39, where it talks about the army of Magog that sets up its camp on the hills of Judea, and that they would be wiped out in such a manner that their equipment would be untouched, and the flesh will fall off their bones, and their bones would be unsafe to touch for 7 months. That sounds like a radioactive signature if you got to wait 7 months before it's safe to even touch the bones and bury the bones. And the fact that none of the equipment is touched, I would tell me it's not a fission device, it's not a fusion device, it's probably a neutron bomb device. So those are the only places I know of in Scripture where it would even hint of a nuclear exchange. But the whole point is God's not going to let that happen until his people finish the job that he gave them, Matthew 28, 18 to 20. That's really the key to interpreting the end times. Yes, John. Depends what kind of neutron bomb you're talking about. Neutron bomb was invented by American physicists in the late 1950s and was never developed because that particular neutron bomb that was invented required a nuclear fission trigger, which meant that you would get radioactive decay. And the reason why our government has never pursued it is they wanted a device that would have no radiation at all. And there's actually, I think, some evidence that that's exactly what our military is pursuing right now, what they call a clean neutron bomb, where you ignite it, not with a fission device, but some kind of plasma device, in which case you could shower, say, a 5-square-mile area with neutrons, and it would wipe out anything that's got protein in it, but would leave all the military equipment, cities, towns, completely intact. And without a radioactive signature, you could move into that area and immediately make use of the facilities. But with a device that was invented in the late 1950s, you'd have to wait a few months before you could move in, because there would be some radioactive decay from the fission triggers that are used. So, as I say, that's a hint. And again, all you got is that one verse in Ezekiel 39, I think it's verse 6, where it talks about how this army of the north coming out of the land of Magog would gather their forces on the mountains of Judea, and there they would suffer a cataclysm where all their soldiers would die, their animals would die, but none of their equipment would be damaged at all, and how the Israelites would wait 7 months before they would bury them. So it fits, but it could be something else. Okay, we only got 2 minutes left. I'm going to suggest that we wrap up Psalm 65 right here and pick up Psalm 104 next time. But let me just read you these last six verses here in the Psalm 65. You take care for the land and water it. You enrich it abundantly. The streams of God are filled with water to provide the people with grain, for so you've ordained it. You drench its furrows, level its ridges, and soften it with showers, and bless its crops. You crown the year with your bounty, and your carts overflow with abundance. The grasslands of the desert overflow, the hills are clothed with gladness, the meadows are covered with flocks, and the valleys are mantled with grain. They shout for joy and sing. So here you got these seven verses which talk about how God has designed the land to provide this abundance. He's designed it in such a way that it can be well watered to provide the abundance. But I will share with you next week, just before we jump into Psalm 104, is how the real limiting factor in food production in the world today is not agricultural land, rather it's water. Water is the limitation. This is a theme you also see in Job 38, that we human beings, in terms of managing the planet for the benefit of all life, need to take special attention to the water resources. That will be the big limitation. And since we're on the subject of end times prophecy in the Bible does predict coming devastating famines in the world, and how those devastating famines are going to initiate water projects that the human species has never ever considered. And that will directly involve North America. North America is the one place in the world where there's a huge amount of water that's never been tapped that could be exploited for agricultural purposes. But that water, in my opinion, will never be tapped until the world faces a food crisis. It'll take a food crisis to force that tapping of the water. Rest of the planet, the water is pretty well tapped out already. But in that sense, We have the capacity to produce even more food than the planet does right now. But what the Bible talks about is the distribution problem. And it's very interesting. But it's predicting in terms of end times. And by the way, none of this is going to happen until Christians are on the verge of completing the Great Commission. We're not there yet, but it could come, what, in the words of Ralph Winter, literally within a decade or two, if we Christians, quote, get on the stick and make things happen like God has told us to make things happen. This could happen quite quickly. But what it actually predicts is that there will be an extreme shortage of food grains, but a tremendous surplus of what it says oil and wine. In other words, fruit and the fats will be available and surplus, but people will be short of grain products. And it's going to be putting pressure on certain portions of the world to exploit water in such a way as to grow grain, to replace the shortages that are there. And in one sense, you can already see that happening. You know, I'm from Canada, and I can tell you what's going on in Canada. One of the world's great producers of wheat, they're turning their wheat fields into rapeseed fields because there's more money to be made making oil than there is to make grain. In fact, my farming friends in Canada say they can make three times as much money per acre with rapeseed than they can with wheat. And so these huge Canadian wheat fields are being converted into oil-producing fields. And, of course, that oil can be used to drive your car. So if you're having trouble getting oil out of the different oil fields, you can get it from the grain fields. And so that could explain the prophecy we see in Revelation chapter 6. Yes? There you go. Well, come next week. We'll tell you about it next week. So it's actually been a plan that's been in effect since 1958. But in my opinion, it won't happen until the world begins to feel a food crunch, because it's just too expensive to put into place. All right. Well, there's one part in North America where you've got one-third of the world's freshwater supplies. It's in a relatively small part of North America. And that water is totally unexploited. Not a drop of it is drunk. Huh? Next week. Father in heaven. Got to do something to make it come back. Father in heaven, we do thank you so much for your word. Thank you for this book that you've given us. That really tells us not only how to run the planet, but how to manage our own lives so that we can enjoy with you eternity in the new creation. We thank you that you've made this planet as bountiful and as beautiful as you have. You didn't have to, but you've done that because of your great love for us. But we thank you too, Lord, that you've promised us a far better place yet in which we can spend eternity with one another and with you. And Lord, I pray that you would enjoin each one of us here, Lord, to take more seriously the instructions that you've given us to wisely manage the planet for our own benefit and the benefit of all life, but more importantly, to do the task that you've given us to take the good news of your message of salvation to all the people groups, that, Lord, that we can hasten the purpose for which you've placed us here on this planet and hasten that day in which we can enjoy a far better realm. In Jesus' name, amen. Look at the big rivers in North America. Kitimat. Yeah. Okay.